Welcome, Serious Eaters, to a special Thanksgiving edition of Call Special Sauce. Serious Eaters from all over the country have sent us Thanksgiving-related questions that they would like us to answer. What we're really trying to do here is take the stress and worry out of your holidays. Here to do the answering and provide the stress reduction are two Serious Eaters who know a thing or two about cooking and baking. Kenji Lopez-Alt, our chief culinary consultant and the best-selling author of The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science, and Stella Parks, our resident pastry wizard and another New York Times best-selling author of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts. Welcome to our special Thanksgiving episode of Call Special Sauce, Kenji and Stella.
Hey, how's it going?
Excellent. And Stella Parks is in the house.
I made it.
The original pastry wizard OG.
Is there another? Is there a new one?
There's thousands of wannabes. But there's only one Stella Parks. Good to have you here, Stella. We have a question. Serious Eater Lonnie Houck, so good to have you on Call Special Sauce.
Well, thank you. I love your special sauce, and I love the website and the blogs, and I use it all the time.
Oh, that's awesome. So I think you have a question for Kenji about turkey cooking.
I do. So I love the reverse sear steak recipe, and we use it all the time in our family, and it's so great. Would you ever use that kind of recipe for turkey?
That's a good question. Okay, so just so people listening, everyone listening knows, the reverse sear is a method where so traditionally what you would do with a steak or a roast is you would sear it at high heat first, and then you would sort of slow cook it until it's finished. The reverse sear is sort of the opposite, where you start it in a low temperature oven and then you finish it at the very end with a high sear. The idea being is that the meat ends up cooking much more evenly, and you also sort of get a better sear on the outside because by the time you're searing it, the exterior is kind of dry, so you don't have to spend a lot of energy driving off excess moisture. So the question is, does that method work on turkeys as well? So the short answer is not really, and the longer answer is yes, but you have to put a little work into it. The problem with turkey and with most poultry is that it's a mix of light. You're cooking the whole animal, and so it's a mix of light and dark meat, so that's fast and slow twitch muscle. And those different groups, so the breast meat and the leg meat, the white meat and the dark meat, need to be cooked to different temperatures. So generally, you want your breast meat to come up to around, well, the government says 165. I say around 155, 150, if you want it to stay juicy. Whereas the leg meat has to come up to around 165, 170, maybe even 175, if you want to get rid of sort of that tougher texture and that really red color, that bloody color, even though it's not blood. Anyhow, so that fact and the fact that you have to achieve two different temperatures in the same bird makes it a little bit difficult to do the reverse sear, because the whole idea of the reverse sear is that you're cooking everything at a very low temperature so that everything cooks very, very evenly. And so what happens is that you end up, by the time the turkey breast meat is at 155, the leg meat's also at 155. And so in order to fully cook the turkey, you end up overcooking the breast or undercooking the legs. So the solution to that, if you want to use that method, and by the way, the method works great. It gives you very, very juicy, evenly cooked meat. If you want to use that method, is to separate the legs from the breast. So you can put them all in the same oven at a relatively low temperature. And as soon as the breast hits 155, you pull it out. And as soon as the legs hit 175, you pull them out. And then you let them rest on the side. And then when you're ready to serve, you pump up the oven to around 500, 550, and throw them back in just to crisp the skin. So it probably takes 10, 15 minutes there to crisp up the skin. The method actually works really great. It gives you very, very crispy skin. It just takes a little bit of extra effort to get there.
Landy, do you feel better now?
I do, and I actually think it would work because we always cook two small turkeys, and I think you could nestle them better than, making it the whole turkey.
That is perfect.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can try it. You just have to make sure that you hit those two different temperatures for the different parts of the turkey.
Great.
Thank you, Lenny, for your question. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Adriana Lotti is on the line. A serious eater, no doubt. Nice to hear from you.
Yes, hi. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So you have a question for Stella.
I do. It's about pie crusts, actually. So my mother, she's an absolute saint. She makes Thanksgiving dinner really well each year. But there's always been a problem with pie crusts, we've found. I'm definitely calling her out right now. But we find that
that is cold, man. You're calling out your mother on Thanksgiving.
I am.
In public.
Yep, I am. Yep, I got her blessing, though, so I'm okay to ask the question. She knows. But, yeah, they always are kind of dry and salty, and they turn out kind of unappetizing and gross, to be honest. So my dad and brother and I all kind of want her to try something new. So we're looking for, like, a new recipe that's maybe sweeter or flakier, or like a pastry for the pie crust.
You know, Adriana, it's a big world of pie dough recipes out there. So, you know, a lot will come down to the style that she's using and the recipe that she has. But not to, like, recipe shame anyone. I'm not even going to ask where this recipe is coming from because, you know what, we don't need to know. The first thing I want to address is salt, though, because that's kind of like a universal to all recipes, is that almost every brand of salt has a different weight per teaspoon. And so if you're not using literally the exact salt that a recipe developer used, unless you're using like a jeweler's scale and measuring by weight, the levels of salt that you're putting into a recipe are always going to be off compared to the whatever a recipe developer is using. So on Serious Eats, we try our best to like specify what brand of salt we're using to at least try and like minimize this variable to like say, hey, I'm using Diamond Crystal kosher salt. And if you use that, that'll put you on the same page. But with a different brand, you might need more or less. So my guess is if it's a super salty crust situation that your mom's probably got like some iodized table salt of like a fine grain, and that whatever recipe she's working with is probably using kosher salt. And by using an iodized table salt style, just a lot more salt per teaspoon is coming into the recipe is my guess on that one. So she may want to investigate if the recipe has called for a kosher salt style that to cut back when using iodized table salt. So switching to a kosher salt, we use Diamond Crystal at Serious Eats. Not because we're like, you know, in the pocket of big salt or anything, but that's just, it's what we all kind of like gravitate towards. It's got a good texture in your hand. I like it because there's no additives, so it's not going to like cause your candies to do anything wacky. Some salts have like anti-caking agents that can kind of wreak havoc on some things.
I mean, but that's kind of a big thing, right, Adriana? You know, it's because it's something that people don't think about a lot when recipes.
It's like a sleeper factor. So anyhow, that's definitely something to look at is like whatever the salt brand is. But otherwise, if it seems like it's dry, it's probably a leaner style of pie dough. And there's a lot of leaner recipes out there. So in a totally like self-aggrandizing sort of way, I'd recommend my recipe because it's equal parts flour and butter by weight. So you're looking at plenty of butter. And it's a very rich style. And part of what that does is it kind of like waterproofs the dough a little bit. So it's like a very rich dough. It bakes up pretty crispy. And it's also less inclined to absorb moisture from the filling because it's already like well saturated with butter, which, I mean, we all want to be well saturated with butter at the holidays. So I would recommend that one. Kenji's got a great recipe also that's a little bit easier to work with. And if you just like, my recipe involves rolling out the dough and kind of folding it a few times to like incorporate some layers, which is great if you want like this kind of flaky pastry like crust. But for some people, that's more work than they want to get into. And Kenji has a very straightforward recipe that you can just kind of like jump in, roll out, no fuss. And so either one of those recipes would be great.
Yeah, there's a whole tender flaky continuum in pie crust.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So either one of those recipes should treat you well. And I'll say for both of them in the comments section on Serious Eats, it is like a huge treasure trove of dialogue regarding every possible troubleshooting issue you could want to go through. And so while that is a little bit overwhelming to you know, deal with, if you just like load up all the comments, you can do like a control F number on your, you know, web browser to search for a keyword. If you want to be like tough or shrinking or something, if you search for that, you'll probably find some person who's commented with a problem and one of us who has responded with a solution.
Adriana, I only have one more question before we have to go. Are you going to pass this on to your mother? You're going to keep this to yourself?
Gosh, I feel like I have to pass it on now. We've given her so much grief over the years. It would just be rude of me not to tell her.
I like this level of honesty with the family. That's good, though. That's healthy. That's how we all grow in our relationships.
Exactly.
We
thank you, Adriana.
That's exactly it.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so much. Have a great day, you guys.
You too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hello, Serious Eater Joyce Brenlinger.
Hi.
It's good to have you on the line, but we have to know before you start, are you going to slander anybody in your family?
No. My family is all excellent cooks.
All right, so talk to us, Joyce.
Okay, I am going about an hour away from here on Thanksgiving. I don't know the people who are hosting, so I don't want to impose upon their kitchen. I would like to make a side dish and bring it, but I'm wondering what would travel well for about an hour in the car.
Hi there, Joyce. How you doing?
Okay.
So as far as your issue goes, I think there's a couple things you could do. I think the most obvious one is to bring dessert. Because most Thanksgiving desserts are made, you know, the day before or the morning of and are totally fine at room temperature. So like a pie travels great at room temperature and it serves great at room temperature. You don't have to reheat it or anything. So I'd say that is the most obvious thing. The next suggestion I would have is a really good salad. And if you're going to transport a salad, I would keep basically all of the greens separate from all of the sort of mix-ins and separate from the dressing. So I'd say like 3 or 4 different little packets that you can then combine and throw together. And that shouldn't be imposing too much on someone's kitchen space. And that, you know, that way your salad doesn't get soggy, your crouton steak crispy, whatever your salad is going to be. Just keep all the elements separate and toss them together at the end. And then my final suggestion would be is if you want to do something hot, I would suggest actually doing a casserole that gets topped with some kind of crunchy topping or a casserole that doesn't need to be crunchy on top, and actually baking it at home, taking it out of the oven just before you leave, and then packing it inside a cooler. So like a, you know, just an insulated cooler. Wrap it in foil, put it inside a cooler. And if there's any kind of crunchy topping, so if you're doing like a green bean casserole with fried onions or anything with breadcrumbs, leave those off and then add them just before you serve them at the end. But if you wrap it in foil and put it in a cooler, a hot casserole out of the oven, it should stay easily hot enough to serve for an hour or so. And casseroles are the kinds of things that, you know, they do fine just sitting for a little while.
Stella, are you okay with Kenji's pronouncement that it's okay if the pie is served at room temperature?
Yeah, pie wants, unless it's like a, you know, a custard cream pie or something like that, it wants to be served at room temperature and travels really well. Cakes travel really well too. Layer cakes travel super well. I've never had a problem with that. You can always, I don't have a cake carrier. I'm kind of notorious on Instagram for posting videos of like driving around with a cake in my floorboard or in my lap. And like everyone's just like, oh my God, you're giving me a heart attack. I'm kind of cavalier like that.
Wait a minute. Are you driving with a cake on your lap and shooting a video of yourself at the same time?
No, like John will be driving and I'm sitting in the passenger seat with a cake in my lap.
Oh, that's different.
Or I'll be pulling out of the driveway with a cake in my floorboard and I'll do a, like a little video while I'm still in my driveway and not anything unsafe. Very safe driver here.
And there is no such thing as a pie airbag, right?
No, you just gotta, you know, let go and let God, Ed. I love Kenji's suggestion on the salad, though. I think a lot of Thanksgiving tables have so many extremely cooked items and like a lot of transformed items. You've got like your mashed potatoes, you've got your corn casseroles, and there's so much going on, and to have like some actual fresh greens at the table is kind
of
a true blessing.
Yeah, it's a relief. All right, Joyce, I think you're in good shape now, right?
Yeah, I think so. Thanks.
Thank you for calling. Hello, Carol P, Serious Eater. Are you in Cali?
Yes.
Talk to us, Carol. What's your question?
Well, I was asked to make a pumpkin pie for a party, and I thought, sure, because I love to bake, no problem. And then, little did I know, I was dealing with a custard, and it was not coming out right. The center never set, and so I managed to rescue all but 2 inches of the center. It didn't overcook, so it didn't curdle and get grainy or anything. It was like pudding, and so I cut out the middle, and then I made a whipped cream and then plopped that on the end so it hit the edge. But then the next morning, I happened to see this email about ask a question. And I was like, oh, this is perfect. Stella will know the answer.
And is your oven temperature accurate?
Yeah, my oven is accurate because I bake a lot, so I always know about that. And I use a recipe from The Best Recipe, and they go through all this stuff and the pitfalls and everything.
All right, Stella, you got to come to Carol's rescue here.
Sure.
Man.
Hey, Carol.
Hi, Stella.
I've got to say, awesome thinking on the fly to fix up that pie the way you've done. Like, that's true brilliance, and I really trust that you're going to handle whatever comes your way next. You know, if anything like a pie, pies are very like communicative as to what their issue is. So if you've got a pie that it's not fully set, it's undercooked, and that's it. Like,
yeah,
it's undercooked. And it's the same thing with cracking. If your pie cracks, right, it's overcooked. Like, it's a pretty binary situation. There is always that kind of a wild card option of like, it happens to everyone from time to time. Like, if you're doing a recipe by weight and there's like a towel on your kitchen counter and just gets nudged too close to the scale, it could actually prevent like the plate from depressing properly. So aside from like some kind of like freak accident where like it's got like five times more milk than it should have,
right,
or you know, some ingredient is like way off base for no reason or unexpectedly. Usually in a case like that, you would notice like you have an extreme volume of pie filling or not enough or something. It would usually show up, but otherwise, it just means it's a little underdone, and that can be caused by a number of things. Even if your oven is running true to dial, it's really normal for a recipe to vary in how much time it takes to bake. That can be influenced by the ingredient temperature. Like, if you're, you know, if the recipe calls for, you know, room temperature eggs, but, you know, you're in a rush and you just grab some eggs straight from the fridge, you know, like, that's fine. It's going to make a difference in how long it's going to take that super cold mixture to cook through versus if the eggs were like lightly warmed or something.
I was just going to jump in. Yeah, like a lot of recipes, all the recipes on Serious Eats, for example, and if you're doing that from the Cook's Illustrated Best Recipe book, probably in there also, rather than relying just on timings, they'll usually give you visual cues or other types of cues to look for. And so they'll say, do it until this, which is about this much time. So it's always a good idea to really pay attention to those cues as opposed to just the timing, because that's going to tell you when it's actually done. Timing is always just an approximation.
No wonder why I have all these problems when I go watch a basketball game after putting a pie in the oven.
It's like the timing is always going to be a rough ballpark figure. It's just like this is our own personal average. And that's like, you know, unless a recipe says set a timer for exactly 3 minutes, like to time some specific stage. Yeah, the timing listed is always going to be just a vague suggestion of what to expect. And the visual cues, the textural cues, those kinds of things will be a little bit more important. And then some recipes will include an internal temperature if you want to use a digital thermometer. That can vary a little bit from recipe to recipe. But for something like a pumpkin pie, I think I'd take my pumpkin pie to an internal temperature of 145 degrees. And I think I want to say that like America's Test Kitchen goes to like 150 or 155.
I think it's 155.
Mine is just like a lower moisture content, and I'm just kind of like budgeting for like carryover cooking. And I'd rather go a little under than a little over. So for various reasons, people will come up with different temperatures.
So the key then is not the oven temperature, but it's actually the temperature of the pie.
Yeah. I mean, it's still not a foolproof method. People want to think that, oh, if you've got a thermometer, like you can't make a mistake. But, you know, placement is everything. Like Kenji's talked a lot about, you know, getting the correct internal temperature of a steak where you've got like this 1-inch to 1.5-inch slab of meat. And how do you correctly judge like the thermometer probe placement? And with a pie, you're dealing with a similarly, you know, it's not super thick. So if you get too close and you're like actually getting more readings from the plate itself, or you're not deep enough and you're not getting as true of a reading as you could. So there's still like a margin of error in how the thermometer is deployed, so to speak. But you want to try and get in like the exact dead center of the pie, both like, you know, vertically and horizontally.
So do you feel, Carol, that you're better equipped to deliver a properly baked pumpkin pie to the table?
Well, I didn't see that thing about the temperature. I might have tried that. I went 5 minutes over, though, and then I was afraid. Isn't it true that if you go past the point and then they will curdle and then it will never set?
No, fortunately, that's it.
No?
You can't go over anything until you've gotten to the place in the first place. So I see people with that on whipped cream a lot. They're like, oh, you know, this whipped cream never thickened. And I was like, oh, really? How long did you whip it? They're like, oh, I whipped it for like 3 minutes. It just never got thick. I'm like, well, you can keep going. They're like, well, I was scared to overwhip it. And it's like, you can't overwhip it until it's properly whipped. And you can't overcook it until it's properly cooked. And you can't overwork a dough until it's properly been worked in the first place. So that's something to, you can just like cut that fear away from you and just be like, you know what? I can't overdo it until I've done it.
Okay.
Right. If it's still jiggly and wet, it's not going to suddenly turn scrambled with skipping over the actually done part.
Don't feel beholden to the timetables too. Like these are like rough ballparks. So if it's like, you know, bake this thing for like 30 minutes and you're on like, you know, an hour and a half, that's a sign that something has gone wrong.
Right.
That's like a good way to like alert yourself, like, oh, maybe my oven's running super low, or maybe this recipe is like, they didn't really do a lot of testing if you just like pulled it off some random website, or, you know, maybe like there's a big discrepancy in equipment or something. But, you know, plus or minus even 10 minutes on the bake time or something is like completely negligible.
Do you feel more confident now, Carol?
Yes, I'm going to try it again. I have to get it right.
Excellent. And just remember to take my advice, which is don't go watch a ball game after you put the pie in the oven.
That sounds easy to follow.
Yeah, you know, it's almost like some of those old recipe books like the Fanny Farmers where the instruction is just cook until done. Like there is something good about that, you know? Like...
Yeah.
I love it.
All right.
Well, all right, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye.
Hello, Serious Eater. Glenn Tate.
Hello.
I don't know. I sense you're from Canada. I don't know. I'm just intuiting that.
That's right. I am.
You sound like you're from Canada. Are you from Ottawa?
No, I'm from Yellowknife, way north.
Yellowknife. That is one of the coolest sounding towns to be from. I'd like to be from Yellowknife. So what's your question, Glenn?
So my question is, where do you sit on putting stuffing inside the turkey? I've done that all my life, and one of the great joys of putting the turkey together is jamming the stuffing into the cavity. Mm-hmm. But I've got a bunch of friends who are all over me about that and rail on me about how dangerous it is and how I'm going to kill myself. So my question is whether or not there are any food safety or other reasons why I shouldn't be cooking my stuffing inside the turkey.
So, Glenn, you've come to the right person because Kenji is actually trained as a turkey intern.
All right.
I have definitely touched the interiors of many turkeys. So the simple answer is yes, there is a food safety issue. And the reason is because when you put that stuffing inside the turkey, the raw juices from the turkey start to kind of soak into it, and they can soak through the stuffing. And so in order to cook the stuffing safely, you have to bring the stuffing up to the same temperature that you would bring the turkey up to. So whether that's 155 degrees or 165 degrees, you know, whatever temperature you're comfortable with, the stuffing has to come to that temperature too. And the issue is that then by that point, generally the breast meat of the turkey is going to be overcooked because the heat travels from, you know, the inside out. So by the time the stuffing is done, the breast meat is overcooked. There's a couple ways around this, you know, because as you say, the stuffing does definitely get a different flavor and texture when it cooks inside the turkey. It's almost more, I mean, it's softer and it definitely has more turkey flavor. And it gets an almost like sort of pudding-like texture that you don't really get when you bake it in a casserole dish in the oven. Now, there's a couple ways you can get around this. So first of all, I don't think there's ever enough space inside a turkey to cook enough stuffing for everybody anyway. So like I always have stuffing on the side. Regardless. The two ways you can go about this, the first way is to roast the turkey. Take it until the breast meat is like maybe at around 150 or so, and then take it out, remove the stuffing, put it in a separate dish, or add it to the stuffing that you have in a separate dish, and then bake, then put them both back in the oven, continue cooking the turkey until it gets to your final temperature, and then cook through that stuffing as well until it's hot. And that way you can sort of separate the two and control the final temperature that you're taking them to make sure they're both safe and that the turkey doesn't get overcooked. The other method that you can use, which is a lot more involved, definitely a lot messier, is that you line, what you do is you take a cheesecloth and you kind of line the interior cavity of the turkey with it. So get like a big square of it and just kind of shove it up inside the cavity of the turkey with the ends hanging out, then stuff all that, stuff the cheesecloth, and then tie off the front of it. So what you essentially end up with is kind of like a interior cheesecloth sack that's full of stuffing. And then what I do is I take that stuffing and I heat it up by itself first in the microwave until it gets to 165. And then while hot, I shove it inside the turkey and then put the whole thing in the oven. And so that sort of jump start on the heat for the stuffing makes sure that it stays hot enough through the entire cooking process that it's safe to eat at the end and it can cook for the entire time inside the turkey. Honestly, I would suggest the first method over the second method because the second method is... it's just a lot of trouble. And the benefits of it are minor compared to the first method. But the short answer is, it is unsafe if you want moist turkey meat, moist breast meat.
And, you know, Glenn, the amazing thing is you're talking to two people in Stella and Kenji that love turkey.
Yes.
I love turkey.
They love turkey. They are unabashedly turkey and even white meat.
I sincerely love turkey.
Me too.
They both love white meat turkey. And then the only other question I have for you, Stella, on the stuffing front, no pun intended, is that, people talk about using stale bread, but you can just put bread in the toaster, right? I mean, there's no magic to the bread getting naturally stale.
I don't know about that. No, because I feel like toasted bread... It seems like it absorbs differently, and it also, develops a flavor. Yeah. I don't know. I am such, bakers are planners by nature. So when I do, stuffing every year, I make my dad's recipe, and he uses a mix of like cornbread and white bread. So I've got plenty of time to knock those both out and let them age naturally.
Yeah. It's something they're dry aged, not wet aged.
Yeah, because then you're also getting just that surface treatment with toast, where sometimes it's still like kind of got a nice moist interior to a slice.
If I could add to that,
it's a lifestyle.
I think like Ed, what you're getting at is that there is a difference between staling and drying, and that generally when you just leave bread out, it gets both stale and dry. So staling is like the retrogradation of starch and how it kind of hardens. So even wrapped bread will harden like that as it cools and it sits over time. So with stuffing, what you really want is dry bread. So you can get it by toasting, but like Stella said, you end up with that brown flavor. The better way to do it, if you have a ton of fresh bread and you really want to make stuffing that day, is rather than toasting, you just kind of dehydrate it. So like a very, very low oven or a very, very slow toaster oven. So you dry out the bread without developing any of the sort of brown flavors, unless you want those brown flavors.
So don't toast it. Yeah, so like put the oven at 250 or something.
Yeah, or even lower, as low as it'll go, basically.
Thank you, Dr. Alt. All right, Glenn, I think you're in good shape now, right?
Absolutely. Thanks so much, you guys.
Thank you. We're back with another caller on Special Sauce. I am Ed Levine, Serious Eats Overlord.
Hi.
Hi, Letitia Johnson. You're in the house.
Hi, guys.
Where are you, man? Because you've got a 917, so it means you were at one point from New York, but God knows where you are right now.
I'm still in New York.
It's good to have a New Yorker on the line because, it's important that we go local even on our phone calls.
Awesome.
No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. Just kidding. Okay. Letitia, what's your question?
Okay. I wanted to know, how can I make holiday cookies, the homemade decorated sugar ones, more manageable and not an all-day affair?
Yes. I fully support this. Hey, Letitia. Thanks for calling. This is Stella.
Hi, Stella.
Baking is a great way. In almost all cases with baking, there are ways to break up a process so you don't have to deal with it all at once. And I fully support that. I think that's a smart way to do it because baking cookies and decorating them should be a lot of fun. With most recipes, including and especially mine, you can make the dough in advance. So if you want to make the dough one day, wrap it up in some plastic wrap and keep it in the fridge, most doughs will keep a couple days. My rolled sugar cookie recipe has specific storage instructions if you want to do that. The biggest trick on the dough aspect is you'll want to bring it back to room temperature before use, because when it's straight from the fridge, it's going to be cold, and that makes it brittle because the butter in the dough is really hard. So as you try and like roll it out, it'll crack a lot. So you want to probably bring it up to something like 70 degrees. So if it's really cool temperature in your house, it might not actually soften fully. So you might want to very carefully pop it in the microwave for like some 3 second bursts, just slowly to nudge it in the right direction. You don't want to totally melt it down, but most doughs, you've got some wiggle room for making it ahead and refrigerating the dough. And then with mine, at least, I like to very lightly knead it once it comes back up to temperature, and that just helps ensure it's nice and pliable and not soft on the exterior, but there's still a cold nugget on the inside. So kind of lightly kneading the dough can kind of homogenize the temperatures and textures. And so that's great right there. You've already got making the dough and rolling the dough on two separate occasions. So that's split up a little bit. And then when it comes to actually rolling and baking the dough, in most cases, you've got a little bit of wiggle room on that side too. So like after you've baked a tray of sugar cookies, the cutout style, you can, you know, wrap the whole tray up of all your finished cookies and hold those for about a day before decorating. So that kind of buys you a little bit more time on that side. And then when it comes to royal icing, which is the most common, you know, decorating method for rolled sugar cookies, royal icing can definitely be made in advance. And what I like to do is have a bunch of small disposable pastry bags. You can pick those up at like stores like Michael's, or I think in my sugar cookie recipe and royal icing recipe on Serious Eats, I think we've got some links to like my favorite brands that you can buy online if you want, instead of like running around to a local store. But you can like go ahead and make up the icing, divide it up, make your different colors, and then bag each color and like just seal the bag really tightly. And it's like a perfectly airtight environment. And you don't have to worry about it kind of like lightly drying out around the edges like it would in a bowl or other container, that even if you wrapped a bowl really well in plastic, the surface is still exposed to air within the bowl and it will dry out a little bit. So that lets you like kind of break up all three stages from making the dough, baking the dough, and decorating the cookies. And that really can lighten up the process, because you can like, you know, make your dough on Monday and bake the cookies on Wednesday and then have a decorating fest with your family on Friday or Saturday or something. And all the recipes on Serious Eats at least have kind of specific storage instructions for, you know, long-term examples. And you can probably extrapolate those to other recipes. So if you're dealing with a family favorite rolled sugar cookie recipe or a family favorite royal icing recipe, you can probably use our storage guidelines as a rough ballpark for what you can get away with those recipes.
Wow.
Your cookies are going to be serious, man. I have no doubt now. Do you?
I just want one more thing was, like, all these recipes have a ton of sugar. How can I, like, ease that down a bit without compromising taste?
Well, here's the thing. I like to say in dessert that sweetness is sugar's least important role. Sugar is there, it affects how the gluten within the dough is formed. So when you reduce the sugar, the cookies may not be as tender as they normally are. The gluten is going to be able to form a little bit more in the dough, and it's going to be like a slightly tougher or stronger dough. And in some cases, that's good. If you're like, you know, these cookies always crumble apart on me and that's a problem. Well, in that case, like scaling down the sugar a small amount, you know, may help. It may help you get a more structured dough. But sugar also determines the shelf life of the cookies. So if you want to have a cookie that you can make in advance and it's going to be okay for a couple days, sugar is what's allowing that. It's what's helping the cookie retain its moisture and flavor over this time period. So if you cut the sugar down, you're going to be losing some of your shelf life issues. Sugar also controls browning and spread and the actual volume of the dough and how much air is able to be incorporated during the creaming phase. It's responsible for so many things. And if all we cared about was sweetness, we would have all switched to like Splenda a long time ago, because you could just get a few drops of something, you know, from an artificial sweetener and just knock it out. But sugar is doing so much. It's like,
wow, I had no
the
idea.
Real heavy lifter. And this is true in any recipe, whether it's, you know, cookies or cake or pie or ice cream or whatever. Sugar is doing a lot. So what you can do, however, on Serious Eats, we have a recipe for toasted sugar. And that's my go-to. You can take
Stella
sugar.
Invented toasted sugar by accident.
Dad. You can take some sugar and put it in a baking dish and toss it in a low oven for a few hours. And when you start to smell like this nice caramel smell, you can just say, I'm done, and take it out. And it's going to be the sugar that you had in the oven. And granted, it's a little bit more complicated than that. You need to stir it during this time period so it doesn't clump. But the sugar develops some caramelized notes, and it's really subtle. It's not like suddenly I have a bowl of, like, you know, Werther's original caramel or something. It's a real subtle change, but if you just take a spoonful of toasted sugar and a spoonful of white sugar and taste both, the toasted sugar tastes dramatically less sweet. It's a real big difference. So lightly toasting some sugar can really help tame down a sense of sweetness within any recipe.
Okay.
Or you can bump up the salt. People have this notion that somehow salt is going to make their things taste sweeter. And maybe in some like vague cases, that's true. Like if you're sprinkling salt on, I don't know, a cantaloupe or something, it can help maybe like bring out some natural sweetness in something by reducing our perception of bitterness. But by and large, if a dessert tastes too sweet, it just needs more salt. So you can bump up the salt. And we were chatting with a caller earlier about how salt is kind of hard to dial in precisely because every brand is a little bit different in how it measures and how much salinity actually delivers to a recipe. So, you know, if you've ever made something, you're like, it just tastes a little flat, or just the flavors aren't popping for me, or it seems a little too sweet, just try bumping up the salt the next go round. And my like personal rule of thumb when dealing with kosher salt is a quarter teaspoon of kosher salt for every cup of sugar. And that's like a gram of salt for every 7 ounces of sugar. I'm mixing my measuring styles here.
You're going deep and precise, Leticia. I think you are golden. You're as golden as toasted sugar.
I am.
I hope that helps. I know for people who are looking to reduce sugar for, you know, caloric or dietary concerns, that's not a lot of help. But at least in terms of flavor profile, I hope that can help you dial that in a little bit better.
Yes, that was what it is for. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Great.
Thank you very much, guys. Enjoy your holidays.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Stella, are you doing the same Thanksgiving dance where you go to your mother-in-law's?
I don't know.
You don't know?
It might be.
This is big news.
It might be. It might be a little up in the air. I don't know if I'm family oversharing. My mother-in-law recently had a surgery, and so my husband and I were going to volunteer to take over some Thanksgiving duties, but I literally don't know if this conversation has been had in my family as of this airing. So, Linda, if you're listening and John hasn't talked to you yet, surprise!
What about you, Kenji?
Actually, my
your family spread out all over.
They are, yeah. So this year, my mom and dad are going to come up from the East Coast, and my younger sister's going to be driving here from Montana. Her and her boyfriend and their dog are all driving over from Montana.
Nice.
Yeah, should be fun.
Nice. So they all can't stay in the guest house. They all
our guest house is under construction right now, so nobody can stay in it. So it's all hotels.
Got it. Yeah. All right. So Kenji, thanks for taking the time, and have a great holiday, man.
All right, you
and,
too.
Give your daughter Alicia the sweetest, most wonderful. Now she's a little older than two, right?
She'll be three in February. Yeah.
That's great. All right.
Bye, Kenji.
All right. Bye-bye, Stella. Bye, Ed.
Stella, that was awesome. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Now it's time for me to give thanks. First, I'd like to thank the Serious Eats community for sending us their questions. I hope we've succeeded in reducing your holiday-related stress. I'm also thankful for everyone who helps make Special Sauce a joy to create, our producer Marty Goldenson, our associate producer Grace Chen, and everyone here at the Radio Arts Foundation Studios and CDM Studios and City Vox. May your holidays be filled with lots of seriously delicious food and drink and the sounds of friends and family enjoying each other's company. So long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.